Sejam bem-vindos ao podcast Physio Frontiers. Essa é uma série especial do portal Fisiortopedia em parceria com a base de dados Pedro Brasil.
O objetivo desse podcast é contribuir para aproximar pesquisa e prática clínica em diferentes contextos, quebrando barreiras linguísticas e trazendo convidados internacionais que fazem a diferença na área.
Eu sou o Bruno Saragiotto.
E eu sou a Tieia Mato.
E juntos nós iremos te guiar nessa jornada pelo mundo.
Prepare-se e vem com a gente!
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Physio Frontiers podcast. This is a partnership between the Physio and Orthopedia and the Physiotherapy Evidence Database Brazil. And today we have a very special guest. We have Dr. Saurabh Sharma. Saurabh is a research fellow at Neuroscience Research Australia at the University of New South Wales. And Saurabh has an impressive track record in musculoskeletal research and also research in low and mid-income countries. So welcome, Saurabh. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Bruno. Thank you, Chia, for the invitation. An honor.
Welcome, Saurabh. So let's just start. And to start, we could probably learn a bit more about you. Could you tell us about your journey and where are you from and what brought you to where you are today?
Thanks, Chia. So I'm Saurabh Sharma. I am originally from Nepal. And I studied physiotherapy in India. So I did my undergraduate degree and came back to Nepal and practiced as a clinician and physio lecturer or instructor, I must say, for 3 years or so. And during that time, I gained interest in managing people with pain. And the trouble that I had was to use all the evidence or answers from English-speaking countries and research and textbook and applying that to our people in Nepal, and which was quite hard because of language and cultural barriers. And in the meantime, as a clinician, I always used to have questions around why, how, like how did we know about the things that we are reading or studying and things like that. And during my undergraduate training, I did not have any experience or exposure to research. So when I learned about research, I knew that all the answers that I had was through research. So I got very keen interest in evidence-based practice and research. So I went back to India to a university called Manipal University, which is among the best universities in India. And the strength of the university was research. So I focused most of my time reading about research and research evidence around musculoskeletal physiotherapy and pain in general, which is my area of interest at that time. And when I came back, I used that knowledge of research into my own clinical practice, as well as developing clinically focused research questions. So during that journey, as you might guess, that at that time, we did not have any research experts in the area of physiotherapy as well as pain. So I posted a few posts in different social media platforms, including LinkedIn and ResearchGate, about collaborative research in Nepal and if anyone was willing to mentor or collaborate in pain research in Nepal. So I luckily got a few responses. So one of the responses that I got on ResearchGate was from Mark Jensen. So he is one of the leading experts in the area of pain. And as soon as he responded, we got connected over email and he closed his ResearchGate. So I think that it was a fate that we were meant to connect that way. And also other researchers, including Professor Blair Smith, Smith from University of Dundee in Scotland, and Professor Joshua Cleland from the US. And all of these were quite meaningful connections at that time. And especially through my collaboration with Professor Mark Jensen, we applied for an IAFP research grant, which we received and which allowed me to collaborate with him and visit University of Washington a few times, and also get Mark Jensen to Nepal and demonstrate our clinical and research setting, and we could optimize the research procedures the best we can based on the limited resources we had at that time. And through that collaborative work, we published quite a few number of papers, and also that led me to do a PhD in New Zealand. And during my PhD, I continued to do the research that I was doing in Nepal, mostly around cultural aspects of pain, cross-cultural adaptation of outcome measures, and also developing pain intervention for Nepali-speaking people in Nepal for people with low back pain. So I continued to do that work, and I was meant to go back to Nepal to join my teaching role, but COVID happened and I couldn't go, and there was this IASB John Bonica grant or fellowship which I applied for and got. So finally I'm here in Sydney to do a postdoc. I've been here for 3 years and a little over, I guess, and I've been doing some global health kind of research around low back pain, which we might be able to chat a little later, I guess, and also developing interventions for people with pain for different culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds.
That's great. Just one thing about your PhD, because when you moved to New Zealand, you already started doing the PhD, and most of your studies were conducted thinking about Nepal or in the Nepali population, right? Was that your plan since the beginning? Like, I want to go overseas, and then I'll keep bringing something to my country. Did you have this thought?
That was the plan from the beginning, because my thinking at that time and also now is that we lack research expertise in our country, and any opportunity to contribute to research in my own country and other countries like my own would be great, because there are challenges of conducting research in countries like Nepal. We don't have the research mindset there, and also the expertise, and most researchers are actually clinicians or teachers, and they don't really have time to do research, or at least high quality research. So the plan from the beginning was to conduct research, like high priority research, in Nepal, and I continued to do that research during my PhD. So what I did was I would travel once every year back to Nepal, spend 3 to 5 months and do intensive data collection, and go back to New Zealand, analyze the data, publish a few papers, and I still had the collaborative relationship with Mark Jensen. So I'd also go to United States and spend a couple of weeks with Mark Jensen at University of Washington and write papers. So every time I went there, I would complete one paper and start another one. So that's how my research during my PhD was quite productive. I continue to do that work even after my PhD. So I supervise students from back home who has been doing some research in the area of pain.
Nice. Yeah. And changing a little bit the topic, Sohrab, but basically following the same thing, we all know your huge involvement in research in low and mid-income countries, and talking more and more about barriers and how to facilitate research on those countries. And so what inspired you? I think your story that you just told us basically led you to do research in this area. But nowadays, what inspired you to actually keep focus on that and advocating for research on these countries, like facilitating research on these countries?
I think that's a great question. Again, that ties to my own background from Nepal. And when I started, there are only 3 papers on PubMed on pain, like with the keyword and title and abstract and all of that. So there weren't many papers. And I think those papers were one from 1980s and one from maybe 60s, 70s, quite old, and one editorial. So not much. And when I did Google Scholar, PubMed, and ExpertScape search for different low and middle income countries, there's so many countries where there aren't any paper at all, so many low and middle income countries. And I see and I understand that the challenges they have are quite similar to what we had back home. And again, the research priority, lack of expertise, and also time. So the overall goal of conducting pain research broadly in many low and middle income countries is to overcome that barrier. So currently I feel really privileged to have this full-time research related role here in Australia. And not many people in low and middle income countries, as you know, have that privilege. And despite the privilege and full-time research role, I still find it quite hard to do research. But yeah, you can guess how harder it is, and I'm sure it was for you as well when you're in Brazil to do research. So yeah, so providing that research support in terms of prioritizing research agenda in these countries and helping young researchers or even clinicians to do research and to bring them to a global landscape of research in the area of musculoskeletal pain so that we provide them opportunity to do research and give them firsthand training in conducting research that is high quality. And also for those who don't have a master's degree and PhD yet, providing scholarship for them to do higher degrees in settings where there are resources to conduct research and also a really good mentorship. So that is the overall goal. And as you know, Sydney is quite well connected nationally and internationally. We have quite a big network of people who want to genuinely help research in low and middle income countries, as well as researchers in these countries, and to build research profile and answer the burning research questions from these countries. So yeah, that is the overall idea and goal, and how I was inspired to what I'm currently doing, and feel very privileged to have support from more extended support from everybody who is involved in the process.
Yeah, that's so amazing.
Yeah.
And in terms of like a big picture, as you can tell us, in terms of behavior, I guess, what do you think need to be changed, or who you think need to be changed to support greater research in those low and middle income countries?
Yeah, I think there needs to be change at several levels. So one of the biggest barrier of conducting high quality research in these countries is the research focus. So research isn't a priority of the nation in general, and also universities. And as a result, there is no research funding for many countries. And for some low and middle income countries, there is some research funding, but not adequate at all. And also the funding isn't targeted towards musculoskeletal pain, because that is the last thing probably they would worry about, because people are dying of other communicable disease. So that should change. So the nation should prioritize research and also think about non-communicable disease, including musculoskeletal pain as a priority, because as you know, and everybody in the audience knows, that musculoskeletal pain is the biggest contributor of disability globally, and this has to be a priority. And also universities. So many universities in many countries, their focus is purely teaching, and research isn't a priority. I think that should change. So there should be research focus and also research-related roles, so that there is capacity building in the field of research, so there are more research assistants and research students conducting high-quality research, and they move on to do a master's degree and a PhD initially from elsewhere, and then they would build the research profile in the country and have those degrees within their own countries as well, and also allocate research-focused postdoctoral roles, so that people continue to do research even after their PhD. So I think that is the need. And the funding body should also focus on research in general. So that could be national Ministry of Health or research councils from different countries. And also global health research priorities should direct some funding to low and middle income countries. And finally, with that kind of research focus and funding, there would be training of research workforce, so researchers at different level, and also opportunities for high quality research training within the country. So I think these are quite needed. And also as there's progress in research productivity, there'd be more students interested in conducting research, and that's how the research workforce might develop in the future.
Good. Yeah, because I feel like last year, Chia and I, we were at the Backpin Forum. There was a session dedicated to low and mid-income countries. Most people in the session, I think more than a half, they were from high-income countries. And then part of the discussion was like, how can you help low and mid-income countries? And what was surprising for me is that they had no idea. They had no idea about the reality. They either they think we are very, 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 very poor and don't have anything, or they just don't know what's going on, which I found challenging. Even though they are keen to help, they were like, yeah, I'm here in this workshop because I support the idea, but I have no idea what to do. And I think that's important. And I think your editorials, I think we're published at 12, 13 journals.
Yeah, 12 journals.
A joint editorial. I think that was a great initiative to start, this awareness. But I do think also that funding agencies, they should start to focus in more. So I have kind of two questions. The first one is just for us to tell us about the background story of the editorials. How the idea came up. And the second part would be if, based on your experience in New Zealand and Australia, with countries with more resource, have you seen much change in funding agents? Have you seen much funding like dedicated to improve health in other countries? So yeah, you can start with the editorial and then we can,
I think these are great questions and something core to my heart as well. So about the editorial in, I think 2020 or maybe 2020, at the World Physiotherapy Congress, I was invited to speak about equity, diversity, and inclusion in one of the focus symposium session with the president of World Physiotherapy at the time. And the area that I wanted to focus in my talk, and it was very brief, only 5 minutes, and there was more time dedicated for discussion. So in that 5 minutes, for that presentation, analyze editorial board of five highest ranked physiotherapy journals, and I demonstrated that there wasn't diversity in the editorial board. I can't remember the number at the moment, but for low income countries, none of the journal had any representation, and from upper and lower middle income countries, I think there are only less than 10% of representation, and most representation was from either Brazil or South Africa, I think. So yeah, not many global voices and eyes to evaluate research that comes out from low and middle income countries. And based on that, so as you highlighted in your example from Backpin Forum, researchers from high income countries have no clue what's going on in low and middle income countries, and they tend to expect the highest quality research work in the biggest possible sample from these countries where resources are nil, no research funding, and they want grammar to be perfect, and which is, I think, a difficult ask and probably not possible. So my point in that talk and in the editorial was that as the journals, which are supposed to be international, aren't really international because they include representation from a few countries, and you've extended from other continents, they only include other high-income countries. So they don't really have the lens to evaluate research from low and middle income countries, because the priorities for research in these countries are quite different, meaning the high end, low income countries. And so I was invited to speak at the Society for International Physiotherapy Journal Editors. So I gave the extended version of the talk, which was an hour long. And most of the editors from the journals involved in that editorial attended. And I proposed this joint editorial to the chair and secretary of the International Society for Physiotherapy Journal Editors, and they accepted. So it was a very long process. I think we started in 2021 and published in 2023. Publishing this kind of work is quite hard. I think, Chia, you did the same with TDR checklist and guideline, which is time intensive, and but it was a fruitful outcome. So there is one part. Did you have any clarification on that part? So that I move on.
I just want to add something. I think it happens to you. I think it has happened to you already, because it happens a lot with me. Those journals, they are supposed to be international journals. They seem to be very international to all high income countries. But as soon as you send a data to a big journal, about like Brazilian data, which we work a lot with Brazilian population, still have Brazilian students. As soon as you send something on a mid-income country, the answer is that you should publish that paper in a local journal. I got the answer so many times. But if I had like any place, any other high-income country, even though it's called, for example, British Journal of Medicine, American Journal of something, they are very open to Denmark, Netherlands, to any other high-income country. But as soon as you send something very specific about a population in need, they always reply, and I got to reply so many times, like, maybe you should focus on a Brazilian journal, on a local journal. Did it ever happen to you?
Always. So first two papers that I wanted to publish in international journals, I think I don't remember the exact number, but I think I submitted them at least 12 times before it was finally published. So it was very hard, and most common reply that I got from the journal editors, and for most of these, for both the papers, it wouldn't even go for peer review. And the reason would be that it's from a small country, and maybe it's relevant for a local journal. So you submit to a local journal. And at one point, I really got annoyed with this response. And that is why I chose that topic in the World Physiotherapy Congress talk. So once, this is really funny and also rewarding, because I sent an email to the editor-in-chief. And the handling editor wasn't the editor-in-chief, so it was someone else. So I sent an email to editor-in-chief saying that this paper, the same argument as you gave, Bruno. So it's from Nepal, but you seem to publish papers from other countries, and you never, and it gets published. And also focusing on the local reach of that paper isn't the ethos of the journal. So if you go back and look at the journal's ethos, you promote high quality research. So I think the assessment criteria should be the quality of paper and not where the paper came from. And if you look about the generalizability of the research, although Nepal is a small country, it has 30 million people and more people than Australia and most of the European countries. So that was my argument. And finally, the editor reconsidered the paper, sent it out for peer review, and it was published. So it was something like that can happen. It's not very common, but you can change the mindset of the editors as well, because they even don't have the international understanding of how research works and what are the research priorities in some of these countries. And I think our role as researcher from low and middle income countries is to educate them as well through various means. And I've been trying to do that. And that joint editorial was an international initiative and also an endorsement from 12 different physiotherapy journals. I think it was a good achievement.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. So yeah, my follow-up question, that was the one, if you have seen in Australia or New Zealand any change in funding or lots of funding opportunities to apply research in low and medium income countries?
Yep. I'm not very sure about New Zealand yet because I haven't tracked, but yeah, there are some research funding in Australia to do research in low and middle income countries. So collaborative research, so you have funding from either NHMRC or other agencies, and the plan would be to have research done in the low or middle income countries. I think UK is leader in this aspect because they have a lot of global health kind of funding, and even fellowship from people from low and middle income countries to advance research in these countries, and even United States through NIH, there are several fundings that's related to either postdoctoral fellowship or PhD or higher education, and also collaborative research grant in low and middle income countries. But I think we need to do better here in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. I think that's important because I think, for example, I think Brazil is ahead of some mid-income countries because I think there's a track history of researchers, especially with Australia, University of Sydney, coming there, be trained, come back to Brazil as better researchers and try to implement something. I think Brazil already had that change of having more people with more research experience coming back to Brazil. Like Tia and I, we went to Australia, we did a PhD, then we came back to Brazil, spent 5 years there. Now we are in Australia again, but still having qualified people. We're still having challenges with funding and all of those like opportunities with journals. So yeah, so I think having more funding is I think it's very, very important. In this scenario. Yeah. I think the only way to improve is having actually like funded trials, funded prospective studies that can be conducted in those countries and having this collaboration. Because I think I've seen somewhere that when you have a collaboration between a high income and a low and mid income country, it's good for both, actually. Mm-hmm. They are not like doing a favor to the low and mid income countries. They actually benefit from better publications, better networking, or even improving their funding. So I think it's great. Like I also like this topic and the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always win-win.
Yeah.
And sometimes researchers from high-income countries, as you say, think that researchers in low- and middle-income countries do not have the expertise, and they only want to provide the expertise even in really basic areas of research, and which sometimes is condescending, I think, because there is the expertise, for example, in Brazil and South Africa, other countries that are really high quality researchers. So maybe the expertise isn't something that they need help with. Maybe funding is a better thing which more resourced researchers could help with. My advice for researchers from high income countries would be to evaluate the state where that particular collaborator from low and middle income countries are, and what is the state of research in general in those countries, and what are their needs before offering something that researchers from low and middle income countries don't need. And I know some people get really offended when those kind of offers are made, and the offers are something that they don't actually need.
And I've been also experiencing with a few studies that I'm involved with, another opportunity that I see is like collecting data in both countries. So if you're based in a high income country and there is a nice like study being developed there, and you have the opportunity to collaborate with something with someone from mid and low and middle income country, and then you can collect exactly the same thing like in both samples and then compare it. It's so rich, isn't it? Like you can have much more like data and understand better the perspective of different samples on that topic that you are interested in. And so yeah, I think this is another opportunity on collaborating.
Yeah, exactly. And which is one of the areas that I'm interested in, and which is the area of need as well, understanding cultural differences in different aspects of health problem and also pain. But one of the challenges, maybe two, are running the studies in the two countries simultaneously, provide a different resource and priorities in these countries. And also the other thing is that not all low and middle income countries have the outcome measures to use in these countries. So that groundwork of translating and validating outcome measures in all the languages is crucial. But again, sure, there are many countries where all the core outcome sets have been translated and conducting research in multiple settings. Comparing results, and also multi-centered clinical trials can be conducted, which I think is a need.
And still on this topic, there is something also that I'm very interested, which is just the low-income countries, because we always put together low and mid-income countries, and Brazil, for example, is upper middle. I think Nepal is lower middle, but I think still within the mid-income, because, well, we did a Delft study. You are an author. We collaborated in a Delft study together. And in this study, we found almost 200 experts in telehealth. And then we have people from every continent, but we don't have anyone representing low-income countries. And we tried. We tried very hard to find. I have a feeling that research in low-income countries almost doesn't exist. And their needs are different. They do need more. I think people willing to help, but I couldn't, I think like I was never able to reach those low income country. Well, now we have a student working in Ethiopia. You were involved in that as well, Sarah. And do you have any tips for how can we reach specifically the low income country? Because I think their needs are even, well, be bigger than those from mid income.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. When I started doing my PhD, Nepal was low-income country, and I kept publishing my research in open access journal with the publication fee waiver for low-income countries. And so finally, when I submitted one paper, they came back saying that Nepal isn't a low-income country, so we can't waive. And then I looked back, Nepal jumped from low-income to upper, lower, middle income. Which is a good thing for the country, but not for publishing in open access journals and getting the waiver. Yeah, it's really hard to find people from low-income countries who have either expertise or who are interested in conducting research. Mm-hmm. I think one platform that is good for this is AuthorAid. So it is a website that has, and I also highlight that in the joint editorial that you mentioned. So it is a website where there are different opportunities within the website, and also there is a platform to register yourself as a mentor, and also a platform to register as mentee. So through that, and it's not only related or specific to health field, it's open for all different specialty. So through that, there is a possible chance to identify people interested in the area of musculoskeletal pain or any pain in general or physiotherapy, and collaborating with them. So that's one. And I also see that people from many countries, especially clinicians and young researcher or someone who wants to become a researcher, active in various social media platforms. Unfortunately, they aren't on Twitter, but on either Facebook or LinkedIn. So LinkedIn can be a good platform for that. If there's a scholarship, for example, in your university, for people from low-income countries, you might advertise through that and also use an existing network. For example, we have currently developed a consortium for low back pain in low and middle income countries. So through that network also, we can identify people who might be interested. But the challenge is that very few people have pre-existing exposure to research, and with lack of understanding of how research works and how authorship works and other aspects of research, it gets really challenging to recruit them as a research student, which I'm currently facing at the moment. Yeah, I keep thinking how best to empower them to at least have the basic understanding of research, so that they are able to appreciate the requirements of high quality research and continue doing their higher education in the area of pain or physiotherapy in high income countries. That's a challenge that we might collectively address.
And just before we go to the final questions, I just want to touch base on telehealth, which is my cup of tea in research. And we all know telehealth was a game changer in during the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. And I was in Brazil at that time studying telehealth. So I think was kind of interesting for a research point of view, because it was already, we were implementing telehealth solutions and we faced so many challenges that I have to change pretty much all the studies that I was doing to adapt to the context, to culture. I just want to know if you have a similar scenario in Nepal, if you have any experience working with telehealth in Nepal. If you can share a little bit on that as well.
Telehealth is definitely, I think, a big thing for the future and for lower and also middle income countries. I think it will get better because the internet access is improving. And for many countries, there are adequate number of mobile phones, and also internet reach and telephone reach is already there in many rural and remote areas. For example, in Nepal, there are more mobile phones than people. So many people have mobile phones, and also internet is accessible in many rural parts of the country. So telehealth will be a big one, and will continue to grow as internet penetrates into more rural areas in the country. Research-wise, we have only been starting to do telehealth research, not a trial as such, but to understand how research administered through web and telephone and online surveys work. And it's been good. So we have done a study comparing measurement properties of a patient-reported outcome measure by use through paper and pen, the traditional method, and also through online telehealth method, either through online surveys and through telephone. The measurement properties are quite similar, but the recruitment of the sample is quite different, because the ones who complete the online measures or via telehealth are either younger or more educated. So the generalizability is a little questionable, or only generalizable to younger and more educated people. But I think as the overall literacy rates continue to improve in many countries, and also through Facebook, I think Facebook is big in so many low and middle countries. Yeah. So more older people are also able to access mobile phones at least, and also use internet for various things. So if we use innovative research methods and data collection method, for example, maybe using pictorial kind of forms can be helpful in collecting data from people who are older and less educated. But yeah, I think this is a growing area of research in general, and also for low and middle income countries, which I think should explore more.
It's great. I'm just thinking more broadly on evidence-based practice, which is something that Pedro is, well, pretty much involved in over the past 20 years. How do you see the difference between the Nepal and Australia in terms of access to evidence-based resource, although Pedro is available over the internet for every country, I just like to get your thoughts on the challenge on evidence-based physiotherapy in general in Nepal and Australia. If you could share a little bit of that, and then Tia will do the last question. We're in the last question for a while.
Yeah, Bruno, a great question. So evidence-based practice in general is quite new in Nepal. As I mentioned, when I went back to Nepal from India with the bachelor's degree, I had no clue what research was and what evidence-based practice was. And we have so many people who's graduated during my time are still working, and even people before that. But the good thing is that the new courses that we have in Nepal have evidence-based practice incorporated within the curriculum. So students are exposed to evidence-based practice from year one, and then that builds on to year two, three, and four. And in year two, three, and four, they start to do literature search and make research, make topic presentation using evidence-based practice paradigm. But my also worry is that many students, once they graduate and go in the clinical practice, they forget what they have learned, or because the general practice within the clinical setting isn't in the paradigm of evidence-based practice, so learning what's new and all of that, they keep practicing what's being practiced in the clinical setting that they are currently working with, and very few people want to make that change and transform the overall clinical practice. But I think that there are some new graduates who are very keen in implementing evidence-based practice and research, and many students or clinicians, they want to do higher degrees and preach evidence-based practice. It's getting better, but yeah, we are not there yet. And even if you look at the Pedro uses in Nepal, not many people use it still, which is disheartening, I think.
Right. Okay, so Saurabh, we'd like to thank you so much for taking your time and talking to us today. And as the very last question, we always want to ask something more personal. And so if you could say a few words on how it is to live far from your home country and far from family. And we know you have a little one as well, growing up far from, you know, family and friends. What would you say?
No, definitely it's a challenge to live outside of the country. And many people who live in their own country don't appreciate that. It's quite challenging. But I do find a way to travel back to my country every now and then, at least once a year. Except for the COVID years, I think I've traveled at least once back to Nepal. And when I do that, I get to meet a family mostly, because of that. Time of travel is quite brief, so, and also catch up with as many friends as possible. I think that's one of the one of the things I live for, I guess. I'm very passionate about my people, and also very patriotic, I think. So I do find ways to travel back and contribute in as many ways as possible, including giving lectures and talks and going to different universities every time, and giving talks to students and clinicians in general through workshops. Living abroad is, again, a privilege, because there are so many things we don't have to think of here, which we have to back home. Simple examples, I'm not sure of Brazil, but Nepal used to be a quite difficult country to live in, because we used to have load shedding, that is power, electricity cut off for 18 hours a day. And that was the time when I did my high school degree and things. And yeah, that was the case for many, many years, and even water. So it's such a privilege to take shower here. You can start anytime you want, and there's no need to worry about the amount of water you spend, although you should. But in Nepal, there is water in the tap only 1 day in 10 days, well, sorry, a few hours in 10 days. So you have to wake up at 3 a.m. to capture that water in water tank on top of your roof, wow. top of your house, and need to allocate and budget that water for 10 days. And if there is power cut off in that particular hour when there is water as well, there'd be water after 20 days. So yeah, it's quite a different setting. So I tend to forget that every now and then, but it's a good reminder to go back home and understand the reality and appreciate everything that we have, the little things that we have here, and also be more empathetic of people in our country, because research is on top of every little thing that goes around in their life, including home. So we need to consider that as well.
Amazing. I think we share a lot of your thoughts as well, living in Australia, but being from Brazil, because people always talk to us like, oh my God, it looks very hard to live apart from family. And it is actually, but Bruno and I think we mostly think this is as an opportunity than like just looking for the downside. So I think we share a lot of your thoughts. Thank you so much, Sarab. Thank you for your time. It was a great pleasure to have you here today.
And thank you all for listening.
Thank you for the invitation, both. And it's a great honor to speak with you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.